Thank you for your practice in silence. It's nice to meditate with others. So I have a tendency to not get up if there's other people in the room. Like at home, I'm often, I always feel like I should do something else. And I meditate at home. Still. So I wanted to talk tonight. I don't do this very often, but once in a while I like to pay homage or talk about specific teachers who have been an inspiration to me and also really to this whole lineage of Against the Stream and mindfulness, insight meditation. So I have this talk prepared on reflections on Ajahn Chah, who is a Thai forest master. And to give you maybe a little bit of background about how we ended up doing what we're doing in the room tonight, really, is that typically or traditionally mindfulness and the Dharma practice that we do here comes down through two very specific schools of Theravada and Buddhism. On one side, we have the Thai forest tradition, which is Ajahn Chah, Thailand forest tradition, and then we have the Burmese tradition. And they teach more or less the same thing in terms of mindfulness, four foundations of mindfulness, Brahmavihara, heart practice meditation, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Buddhist psychology. They're all the same stuff, the same lists. However, the way that the practice is applied and the application and the emphasis is actually quite diverse. And I'm much, in the last several years, and really lately, very much resonate deeply with the Ajahn Chah approach or the Thai forest approach feels like it's more helpful to me personally, and it also feels like it's more relevant for us. Us meaning busy Americans who have all kinds of shit going on all the time. And the Burmese tradition is kind of more of a training the mind, diligent effort, training the mind, effort to awaken the heart. And the Thai forest tradition to me seems much more like softening the heart, and the mind will eventually get on board. Actually, feels more helpful to me that the more I've put emphasis on softening my heart and feeling more compassionate and more kind to my experience, my mind kind of has gotten on board with that. I'm like, oh yeah, this is good. This is good, we'll do this. We'll be less judgmental, less angry. It also feels like, to me, the teachings of Ajahn Chah feel like an old t-shirt. You know, like the t-shirt you have in your closet that you really shouldn't wear anymore because it's full of holes, but you put it on and you're like, ah. This t-shirt is that t-shirt for me, actually. I actually stole this t-shirt from Noah Levine about 3 years ago. And it already was broken in, so it's like extra broken in. I would wear it every day if I could, actually. It's such a comfortable t-shirt. Or an old pair of shoes. I'm sure you have that item, right? You just put it on and you're like, oh, it's my good shoes, my comfortable shoes. This really feels like that to me. And I'll start off by saying this is one of the things that Ajahn Chah talks about in a body of teachings he calls a still forest pool. And he says, try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surrounding, like a still forest pool. And all kinds of strange and wonderful creatures will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but your mind will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. And I love that idea that my mind is becoming this still forest pool, and the thoughts, the emotions, the fear, the discomfort, all of it are just these strange and wonderful creatures that come for a little while, have a drink, and then they leave. But I'm unaffected. The anger comes in. No problem. May I be at ease with my anger. The fear comes in. The judgment comes in. There are all these, like, you know, like these parts of our experience or these voices or these memories or these stories, right? We have all these stories about ourselves. And they come for a little while, they take a drink, they hang out, and they leave. And he's saying that with mindfulness, by practice, that we eventually just become able to be at ease and to be still with that reality. Because none of them stay forever. You know, every emotion that you've experienced has already passed away. And most of them will re-arise again. So nothing stays, good and bad. And so we have to learn how to rest into that, to be at ease with that reality. There's a softening of that, right? And all these things show up in the mind, and it's like, okay, right now it's like this. That also comes from Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Sumedho, who's an English forest monk, has that phrase, which I love, which right now it's like this. This is what it's like right now. And it won't be like this for very long, actually. Right? There's no reason to push it away or to take it hostage because it's going to leave. If it's a nice, friendly creature, let it stay, be. Don't try to take it hostage, right? If it's a angry, hateful creature, just be nice, it'll leave. Right? All of those things. He also talks about, I want to spend some time on this because this has been very helpful to me. Ajahn Chah talks about there being two kinds of suffering. And he says there are two kinds of suffering. One, there is the suffering that leads to more suffering. And then that the other kind is the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. And if you are not willing to face the second kind of suffering, you will certainly continue to experience the first. And I think when it comes to softening our awareness or softening our heart, we have got to get ourselves in some attitude or some level of reality that acknowledges that we're going to have to be willing to face some of our pain, our anguish, our suffering, our sadness, our unattended sorrow. People oftentimes come to Buddhism and they hear about suffering and then they hear about like nirvana or they hear about the end of suffering. And they're like, yeah, let's do that. Let's talk about that. And even as somebody who's been practicing for a long time and knows this stuff, I often, when I find myself in a situation where I'm suffering, even if it's just a little bit, I immediately go into this. This shouldn't be happening. I shouldn't fucking be suffering right now. I'm a practicing Buddhist, man. And the first instruction is to be mindful of suffering. I want to graduate from that practice so badly. You know what I mean? I want to totally get to the next level. So bad. And the idea that there is a next level is just that first kind of suffering. It's the suffering that leads to suffering. Experience. And the reality that we don't like to or want to or aren't very interested in our vulnerability, in our sense of not being comfortable, and our sense of not being wanted or liked or fit in, or all of this yucky part of our emotional experience that we just, like, we don't even really want to talk about. We actually have to pay people to talk about that shit sometimes. I'm going to pay somebody to talk about this because they won't tell anybody. They've taken an oath to keep my shit locked up. So I'm going to give them $150. To promise to not fucking tell anybody about this. That we live in a culture where that's very much something that people do. And it's very useful and very valuable to a certain degree. But to me it's interesting that it's come to that reality. And so if we're not willing to be with our messiness, that's the first kind of suffering that just leads to more to it, because then we resist it, we push it away, we don't want it, we lie to ourselves, we deny that it's there. And we just kind of keep it at bay. And then there's the other kind of suffering, where there's a willingness to look at it, to be with it, to hold it, to meet it with kindness and compassion, to become interested in it. And that's the kind of suffering that leads to the end of it. That's what it takes. Always. Always, always. This word we say oftentimes, let go, you know, we hear this in a lot of, such a self-help fucking term, right? Doesn't matter whether it's Buddhism or recovery or any self-help book, man, has got a chapter on letting go. And it's like, we want to let go before we let in. You know what I mean? It should be like more emphasis on letting in. Because it's like, we want to let go of things. We want to let go. We want to be free from it before we've even let it, allowed it to come into existence. It's like the emotion that's looming right over here. And you're like, I'll totally let it go. It's like, it's got to come through the system. You know? But we don't want to, I don't want to do that. How do I not do that? That's always the question you get as a meditation teacher. How do I not feel stuff? Show me how to repress this. I'm not doing a very good job. You know? Isn't that the question we all want to know the answer to? You know? And that's the suffering that leads to more suffering. And so how can we get ourselves in some sort of willingness or attitude where we're going to get into that murky water of unresolved, whether it's trauma or emotions or relationships that didn't pan out or whatever. There's usually a wide range of that type of experience. But the good news is, the promise is, and the reality is, if we're willing to do that, that we can actually be free from it. And that's really the whole of the Dharma, is to be willing to do that. To have the humility and the courage to say, all right, if this is what it takes, so be it. Then we do it a little bit and we get a little bit of freedom. So then it becomes our practice. The long-term practice begins, you know, we kind of get reintroduced to that again. And we're like, oh, this again? Shit, I thought I'd work this out. It's this idea that, you know, like when I think about, like, you know, heartbreak or where our hearts get broken, they can get broken in one of two ways. It's like we can break the heart open into kindness and compassion and forgiveness and break it open and like, oh, wow, I have all these things inside of me that actually help heal. Or we don't explore that reality or we can't embody those types of ideas. And so the heart breaks open and we kind of shrink back and we become more scared and we become less willing to face. And it can really go either way. For me, I was very fortunate that the first experience I had in the practice, and I was talking to somebody about this outside earlier, about the relief of mindfulness of breathing. For me, I was like at a really good time where like it was all of, for me, it was what broke my heart open into like freedom. I was like, oh, it's okay to suffer. Like, I have fucking permission to suffer. You know, the Buddha saying, like, it's the first noble truth. And giving my, and just having some level of permission around it. Like, it's okay to really be in pain. It's okay to really be sad. It's okay to feel loss. It's okay to suffer. It's okay to feel whatever it is that's screaming for your attention. And you're like, go away. Go away. Go away. Go away. And it never goes away, does it? And then until we actually turn towards it, and then it's like, then it becomes the boogeyman, right? It's like, oh, that wasn't so bad. You know? Actually, I feel much better now. It's like when we feel like we're going to cry, maybe in a situation, maybe we don't want to, so we get that tightness. But actually, if we let ourselves cry, if we just explode, 10 minutes later, you feel so good. You're like, oh, that was so good. But we don't want, you know what I mean, depending on where we are and who we're with, we don't necessarily want to let ourselves have that. You know, it was really hard for me growing up, too, because it was my big message, you know, from my dad and from my family and from the world I grew up in. It was like, men don't cry. Boys don't cry. Your little sister's allowed to cry, but you're not allowed to cry. It's like, fuck. I feel like crying. Or the old-fashioned, shut up before I give you something to cry about. I heard that a couple times. I was like, I'm already crying, man. It's like there was no permission. It wasn't, like, allowed. It was a sign of weakness. I meant I was weak. I meant we're weak. We're emotional. She's so emotional. He's so emotional. It's like, yeah, good. I want to meet this person. You know? Everybody walking around with their all this tightness around their heart. It's like they're so scared that anybody's going to see inside. You know, I'm not interested in that anymore. It's like I was... there's this researcher named Brené Brown who I've been really interested in, who really studies this stuff. She studies shame and vulnerability and she studies, she's like interested from a research perspective on all these things. And she says this, which I think is very true, and I've been noticing it lately when I meet people that I don't know, is actually like as I meet you, the first thing I want to see in you is vulnerability. I want to see you be genuine. I want to see you be authentic. I want to get a sense of realness from you. I'm attracted to that. I want that. That's what I want to see in people. But it's the last thing I want you to see in me. Which is why we're all so fucked up. Because we're all looking for the one thing we ain't going to show. Then it's like, you show me a little vulnerability, I'll show you a little bit. You know, and then we have people in our lives where we get into a really healthy relationship, friends, partners, whatever, where we're able to do that, and we're like, oh, this is the greatest thing in the world. Think about your best friend that you would tell anything to. You know, that's the best relationship, right? That's what we want. But as we go out into the world and we meet people and we come and we're confronted by this on a daily basis, we're always, there's always that back, like what's going on backstage, right? It's like we don't really want people to know. So we give them a little bit, throw out a little vulnerability and see how they react. I'm like, ooh, that didn't go so good. Or, oh, that went good, I'll try it. I'll go a little farther. It's like that give and take. That's why I love doing these relational mindfulness exercises with people where you sit in front of somebody else and kind of talk about this stuff and are actually kind of in a group environment forced to be real. That we actually a lot of times have to go to these weekend workshops and we have to go to places like OnSite and we have to go to all these great facilities so we can learn how to fucking be human and not be scared. We have to have like a team of therapists on site. We're like, okay, ready? Everybody ready? We're going to practice telling the truth. It's like, okay. I'm ready. We start talking about our suffering, you know? And then by the end of the day, we're like, wow, everybody's suffering. Oh, shit. Permission to talk about it. Permission to feel it. Permission to let it in. And that's a lifelong process right there, working with those two types of suffering, right? There's a sutta that the Buddha talks about that I like a lot called the idea of this sutta is called the second arrow. And he talks about the difference between, well, I'll just read it. So there's two people, there's the untrained worldling, which I don't want to be an untrained worldling, and then there's the noble disciple. So there's basically the person who meditates and then the person who doesn't meditate. Is how you would phrase it. The untrained worldling, experiences pleasant feelings, he experiences painful feelings, and he experiences neutral feelings. A well-taught noble disciple, likewise, also experiences pleasant, painful, and neutral feelings. Now, what is the distinction, the diversity, and the difference that exists between these two? When an untrained worldling is touched by a painful feeling, he worries and grieves, laments and weeps, and is distressed. Thus he experiences two types of feelings, a bodily feeling and a mental feeling. It is as if a man were shot by an arrow. Following the first arrow, he is hit by a second arrow. So that person will experience two unpleasant feelings. It is similar with the untrained worldling. Right, so he experiences these two. So there's like that, like we get a hit of pain, whether it's physical pain, emotional pain, or mental pain. And then we like don't like it or we hate it. We kind of hit ourselves with the second arrow. We're not able to meet it. Having been touched by that painful feeling, he resists and resents it. Then in him who resists and resents that painful feeling, an underlying tendency of resistance against that painful feeling comes to underlie his mind. Under the impact of that painful feeling, he then proceeds to distract himself with sensual pleasure. And why does he do this? An untrained worldling does not know any other escape from painful feelings except the enjoyment and distraction of sensual pleasure. As he indulges in sensual pleasure and distraction, an underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feelings comes to underlie his mind and forms a habit. He does not know, according to facts, the arising and ending of these feelings, nor does he understand the gratification, the danger, and the escape connected with these feelings. So we don't know what to do with pain other than resist it, resent it, push it away. And so we shoot ourselves with a second arrow. You know, we lose a job or a relationship, or we just stub our toe. It doesn't matter. Pain is pain, whether it's emotional, mental, or physical pain. If we're not trained, if we don't understand the nature of this, we experience this second hit of pain. I hate this. I want to feel this. I take it personally. It's my fault. This emotional pain is my fault. So there's emotional pain, and then it's my fault. I don't know if you're familiar with it's my fault, but that hurts. That's a painful experience. And so the case with the well-taught noble disciples is touched by a painful feeling. He will not worry nor grieve or lament. He will not weep in despair, nor will he be distressed. It is one kind of feeling he experiences, a bodily one, not a mental feeling. It is as if he was shot by an arrow and did not get hit by the second arrow. Having been touched by that painful feeling, he does not resist and resent. Hence, in him, no underlying tendency of resistance against that feeling comes to underlie his mind. Under the impact of that painful feeling, he does not proceed to cling and distract to sensual pleasure. And why not? As a well-taught noble disciple knows of an escape from painful feelings other than indulging in sensual pleasure. Then in him, why does not proceed to do this? No underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feelings comes to underlie his mind. He knows, according to facts, the arising and ending of those feelings, and the gratification, the danger, and the escape connected with these feelings. And so that's what we're moving towards. That's the goal, that's the aim, is to not shoot ourselves with the second arrow. And we do this, and whether, like I said, whether it's physical, emotional, mental, there's that second arrow experience. That attitude of this shouldn't be happening right now. This shouldn't have happened. Why does this keep happening? It's my fault. There's something wrong with me. Whatever. And we get pulled into that habit. So there's this kind of shift that's being asked to basically allow yourself to feel the pain. Permission to experience pain. And pain is kind of a loose word, but it's like just that sense of unpleasantness, discomfort, not fitting in, not being wanted, whatever it is. It shows up in a wide variety of experiences, doesn't it? Very wide range. And so Ajahn Chah is very clear about this, about that there's two kinds of suffering. And also, too, I think that it's really important to acknowledge the how does the noble disciple not do this. And it's not necessarily this intellectual understanding of like, oh, I'm not going to shoot myself with the second arrow, as much as it's learning how to hold the pain of the first arrow, learning how to develop simple things like kindness, which we did tonight, which I always do in mindfulness practice. Learning how to meet pain with compassion. How do we meet pain with compassion? And it's not really necessarily a choice, is it? It's not something you can just choose to do. Sometimes it's maybe that simple. But I think this is a practice that we need to work for. We need to put some effort into that. Compassion is, from my experience, is not my habitual reaction to any form of pain whatsoever. Compassion does not naturally arise. I don't have that habit yet. A little bit I do. I feel like I'm getting a little bit that habit. But mostly the habit is, I fucking don't like this. I hate this. This needs to go away. I don't want this to be here. You know? I hate it. Discomfort, mental discomfort, stress, anxiety, emotional discomfort. Vulnerability. I hate feeling vulnerable. Really? You know, as I'm able to work through it in certain situations, there's a liberation that comes through it. But the first hit of I'm feeling vulnerable, I'm not like, oh, cool, an opportunity for spiritual growth. I don't see vulnerability as an opportunity. It's usually on the other side of it, I can look back and go, oh, that was really good for me, or that was really healthy, or that wasn't so bad, really. That wasn't so bad. And then when that situation arises again, I have a little bit of confidence because I've worked with it. I'm like, oh, I can do this. I can handle this. I can hold this. And so there's, you know, this tremendous emphasis in Buddhism, in really all schools of Buddhism, for the development of compassion within mindfulness. What is it that's arising? How am I holding it? What is it that's arising? How am I holding it? It's a two-part practice. And I really like the simplicity of Ajahn Chah in terms of, like, really trying to get us to soften first. And I think if you are new to meditation and you're interested in mindfulness and you've been practicing it for a little while, maybe you've noticed it's kind of hard or difficult, I think the best thing that you can do actually is to try to be kind and friendly and not be worried about so much about whether how many moments you're in the present. If you can sit in meditation and be kind to yourself, you're likely to sit in meditation again. You're likely to do it. So I think that really the first development is we really want to emphasize the kindness, the friendliness towards the mind as it continues to do whatever it wants to do, regardless of whether or not you came over here or not. Your mind doesn't care that you're meditating. At least mine doesn't. It's like, you meditate, I got shit to do. This is fucking boring. This again? You know? Really? This is what we're going to do right now. All right. You know, the kind of attitude is like there's this struggle. And the Buddha set points to that. He's like, yeah, this is difficult. This is not easy. Your mind does not want you to see what it's up to. I read this really disturbing and very fascinating quote that somebody I know, another Buddhist teacher that I really like, named Michael Stone, who's in Toronto. He is a really out there teacher. And he's a really, really cool guy. I actually shared a room with him for 3 days at a Buddhist teachers conference. And he said that, what did he say? He said that when you die, you go to the same place that you go to when you meditate. And I was like, fuck. I was like, I'm going to meditate right now. I'm going to get this shit down. Imagine that, though. When you die, you go to the same place that you go to when you meditate. Does that make you want to get your shit together? A little bit? Right? I think that is like, it's like a Zen koan. And it's like, I think it's designed to put you in a position to maybe bring a little more effort to your meditation practice. Right. So I want to read a couple things to close out the stuff on Ajahn Chah. This is one of his teachings that's entitled Underground Water. And I really love the way that this sounds and the way that it feels. So it's called Underground Water. And he says, the Dharma belongs to no one. It has no owner. It arises in the world. It arises when a world manifests, yet stands alone as the truth. It is always here, unmoving, limitless, for all who seek it. It is like underground water. Whoever digs a well will find it. Yet whether or not you dig, it's always there, underlying all things. In our search for the Dharma, we search too far. We overreach, overlooking the essence. But it's right here, nearest to us, our true essence. There are no problems, no troubles, good, bad, pleasure, pain, light, dark, self, other, are all empty phenomena. if we come to know this essence, we die to our old sense of self and become truly free. We practice to give up, not to attain. Before we can give up mind and body, we must know their true nature. Then non-attachment naturally arises. Nothing is me or mine. All is impermanent. But why can't we say nirvana is mine? Because those who realize nirvana do not have thoughts of me or mine. If they did, they could not realize nirvana. Although they know the sweetness of honey, they do not think, I am tasting the sweetness of honey. The Dharma path is to keep walking forward, but true Dharma has no going forward, no going backward, no standing still. And I have no idea what that means. But I love it. And then Ajahn Chah says, just let go. Do everything with a mind that lets go. Do not expect any praise or reward. If you let go a little, you will have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you will have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will know complete peace and freedom. And your struggles with the world will have come to an end. So if you could just remember to do that.